David, you know, what is the thing about development and others?
You may proceed.
Morning, may I please report to Rainsbury for appellant Dorothy Davis. My client, Ms. Davis, is the plaintiff in an LLC derivative action. The trial court dismissed her action because before filing it, she did not make formal demand on the LLC. This appeal raises two distinct issues. The first question is whether a derivative suit plaintiff must make a formal demand on the LLC, where doing so would be futile. We submit that the answer is no, and that the futility exception to the demand requirement survived the 2011 amendments to the LLC Act. The second distinct question is whether a party who does not make demand can cure the lack of pre-suit demand by making a post-suit demand and then waiting the statutory 90 days before resuming the action. And we submit that the answer to this question is yes, because waiting that 90 days satisfies the statutory purpose of making demand. It allows the LLC to determine whether to bring the action itself rather than have the plaintiff bring it derivatively. The trial court got the answers to both of these questions wrong, and this court should reverse. Now, I know the court's reviewed the record and background of this case, but I want to point out a few facts that highlight why this case is exactly the sort of case where the futility exception should apply. Now, my client owns 72% of the LLC. But
let me ask you a question real quickly at the outset. Was it dismissed with or without prejudice?
The draft order that was tendered by the defendants said with prejudice, and the court struck out the with.
That's what I thought. So it has been dismissed without prejudice.
That's the way I read what the court did. Yes,
what
sir.
Other way would there be to read it? The court struck it out and said without. I mean, that's as binding as anything else, isn't it? So it's without prejudice.
That's how we interpret the court's ruling.
So you can file it again?
We can refile, yes, sir.
I don't mean to be terribly blunt, but why are we here if you can refile it?
So are you saying that there's no appellate jurisdiction?
No, I'm saying why
wouldn't you just refile instead of spending the money to come here?
Instead of spending all the time with us.
Oh, I see. Well, because as their brief makes clear, they intend to assert the statute of limitations argument. The limitations period has run. And so their argument, I think, if we refile, is going to be that the limitations has expired and the case is barred. And we want to preclude that argument.
All right. That makes sense. Go ahead.
So Ms. Davis, she owns nearly all of this LLC, but she doesn't control it for various estate planning and creditors' rights reasons. Control was divested, and she gave control to her children. And now the LLC is basically controlled by her two sons. And, I mean, it's controlled by an entity that's controlled by the two sons, but for all practical purposes, it's her sons who control the LLC. And the allegations in the complaint are that the sons are breaching their fiduciary duty to the LLC. And again, the LLC holds property, and its main source of income is rent from property on which the sons have a business. So the sons, as managers of the LLC, have the obligation to collect rent from themselves. And their sons have not been doing a very good job of it, and there are millions of dollars in arrears. So Dorothy brought this action against them for breach of their fiduciary duty, for not doing their duty to collect the rent.
Well, it's pretty much a given in our dialogue with you that futility has been prima facie alleged, so you don't need to elaborate on it. Tell us exactly why the 2011 amendments do not change the common law.
Well, there is nothing in the 2011 amendments that expressly abrogates the common law futility exception. Now, the futility exception, as we point out in the brief, was recognized at common law in Virginia. Under the ordinary rule, with the common law rule, if the General Assembly intends to abrogate it, it has to do so expressly in the terms of the statute itself. And there is nothing in the terms of the statute itself that abrogates that rule.
Well, to be sure, that the statute includes a provision that says that unless displaced, which would imply expressly, unless expressly displaced, the common law still governs.
That's exactly right. So it's belts and suspenders. Not only do you have this general rule that if you want to abrogate the common law, you must do so expressly, the LLC Act itself has a provision that says that if you want that, well, first, that the Act is supplemented by the common law.
So I guess the point is this is a belt and suspenders case as opposed to a mere belt case, because that's sort of the way the argument's been framed in the brief is, oh, there's silence. It was there before, now there's silence. And that's a problematic judgment call, I think. But we have a statutory provision that says no, unless we expressly disclaim it, the common law still governs. That seems to me to be a different case.
I think they reached the same result. The common law forms the background, and the LLC Act is an overlay on that. Part of the common law is the futility exception to the demand requirement.
Can I ask you this? Where did that come from? We call it the common law. We cite a bunch of cases from the 1800s. Where did it come from? Did it come from English common law?
I'll have to look back at that 19th century case that we cited in the brief. But it is an established part of Virginia common law and rules of equity. And it's just a common sense rule. When you're basically...
Common law is different from judicial doctrines that had no origin in English common law. That's just judicial management of proceedings. It doesn't have the same ranking as...
To be sure, Virginia has adopted the English common law, but it's elaborated on it as well. And that's what to the extent that it's an elaboration, that's what the court did in the 19th century case. But ultimately, the rule is one of common sense. If a corporation is controlled by a board that's engaged in the very wrongdoing that's alleged in the complaint, it doesn't make any sense to ask the board, to demand the board, basically to sue itself. And the law recognizes that. As in other cases, the law doesn't demand a futile act. And that's what that would be here. And the LLC Act itself says that you have to expressly displace. So even if it weren't derived from common law, the General Assembly has bound its own hands and said that if we want to displace a pre-existing rule, we need to do so expressly. And the futility exception is exactly that kind of rule. Now, defendants have not challenged the premises of our argument. They haven't challenged the premise that futility exception was recognized in common law. They haven't challenged the premise that the common law supplements the LLC Act. They haven't challenged our argument that there's no express abrogation of this common law rule. What they argue is that if you look at statutory history, there once was a provision that had a futility exception. Now there's not, so you can infer that the court intended to get rid of it. There are a number of problems with that argument. Primarily and foremost is the continued existence of Section 13.1, 1044. And this sets forth the pleading requirements for derivative actions. And if you look at 1044, It says that a derivative suit plaintiff can either plead demand on the management of the LLC, or they can plead the reasons why they haven't made demand. And that pretty clearly indicates that the utility exception is still alive and well. At the very least, it shows that if the General Assembly wanted to express its intent to abrogate it, it needed to change that provision. And it didn't change that provision.
Well,
it's still in
what significance do you afford the removal of the futility exception? What does that, does it mean anything? Mean at all?
Well, Your Honor, the 2011 amendments did a lot of things to 1042. They completely reconfigured it, broke it into separate subsections. They actually untethered it from the Stock Corporation Act. It used to be tethered to that. And so they dropped off this language. It's clear, but it's uncertain what that actually means. And, you know, I think in an ordinary case where you weren't, where a common law rule were not involved, you might be able to infer an intent from the dropping of this, but where you have a common law principle, one that's been the established law of Virginia for over 100 years, if you want to change it, you need to do so expressly. And
so the removal essentially, under your argument, by virtue of 1044, among other things, just defaults us back to case law. So it removes an express textual provision that deals with this futility exception. But then other parts of the statute just send you back to the common law, and that supplies the role of decision.
That's right, Your Honor. And it's not just me who's saying that. It's the LLC Act. If you look at 1001.1, it says that you know, the common law still applies, and to the extent it's not expressly superseded by the terms of the statute, the common law applies. And that's exactly what our argument is.
This may be a very technical point, but doesn't it say the principles of law and equity?
It says principles of law and equity.
So, so going back to Justice McCullough's point, there could be case law interpretations and doctrines that have developed since the English common law that would not trigger the reception statute, but would still be incorporated by reference by the Act.
Well, Your Honor, with respect, the common law didn't freeze at the time of the adoption of the Constitution.
I think that's a friendly question. I could be mistaken.
It was.
I think it was a friendly question.
Okay.
Anyway.
Well, absolutely, Your Honor. if I can just turn briefly, I see I'm running out of time, to the remedy question. Our proposition is just that when determining the remedy, you need to look to the purpose of the rule. And the purpose of the demand rule is to give the LLC time to consider whether to undertake the action itself. And that purpose is satisfied by waiting 90 days and then proceeding. It doesn't make any sense to throw out the entire case and have it renewed again. You know, the LLC in this case has had plenty of time to decide whether to bring suit. Let's not kid ourselves. They're not going to do it. The Sun, they're not going to sue themselves. But they've had more than a statutory period to decide. So they're not harmed by the fact that the demand occurred after filing a complaint rather than before. So I'd like to reserve my remaining time for
all right.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. My name is Joseph Pope. 13.1-1042 contains an exceptionless demand requirement. The 2011 amendments made express through the omission of this demand requirement, that under Virginia law, there is no futility exception.
So if the demand requirement's not met, does that forfeit the court's subject matter jurisdiction over the case?
Yes, Your Honor, it does.
So if we uncover a derivative action 20 years ago where there was no demand, we could hold it void ab initio.
If, I'm so sorry, Your Honor, if you discover a...
If a court lacks subject matter jurisdiction because of a procedural default, which is itself sort of an anomalous statement because it normally doesn't, it means the case, and whatever the court does, even if it grants affirmative relief, is void ab initio, and everything can be set back to where it was. It's the ultimate weapon against the finality of judgments. We rarely, and particularly in recent years, go that far. But you're asking us to go that far here.
Well, Your Honor, we are. And the standing, this is a... You can just move to that argument. This is and does implicate directly standing. The demand requirement, and this is adopting, we cited in our cases, we cited in our brief, cases from other states, Ohio, Nevada, and to my knowledge, North Carolina, South Carolina, Alabama, Delaware, California, Texas. All of those states have deemed the demand requirement to be one of standing. And the courts have said that it implicates who may bring the action and how they can bring the action.
But standing is a very amorphous concept. It's used in a lot of different ways. And sometimes it's misused to describe a condition precedent, a procedural condition precedent that has absolutely no effect whatsoever on the subject matter jurisdiction of the court. Why isn't this provision an obvious, mere procedural condition precedent?
Because this procedure, this provision, endows the member with the ability and the power to go forward with the action. See, this...
Well, so does serving a complaint. I mean, if that were the definition, all requirements that are necessary to initiate a lawsuit would be standing. Traditionally, standing just means you have enough interest in the case to actually show up and say something about it.
Well, Your Honor, with respect, before you file, let's say the Bessler case, before a medical malpractice claimant brings the action, they have to have and possess the cause of action. So the medical malpractice claimant, being the person injured, necessarily has... possesses, if you want to use common law parlance, the chosen action is possessed by the plaintiff. In the LLC context, before the member can possess the cause of action, they have to satisfy the demand requirement.
Then why would 1044 tell the pleader, when you sit down and type out your complaint, you can say, look, I didn't get the demand done, but that was obviously futile. And you just got to explain yourself. Why would 1044 tell you that? It would almost be misleading. The statute traps you into making a mistake.
Well, Your Honor, there's two responses to that. 1044 provides that, nowhere provides or states demand. Nowhere uses that language. It states the pleader must use efforts. So efforts could be seeking mediation, private meetings with the members or the corporate governors.
But not sending them a letter saying, please take care of this problem? That's not an effort.
Well, yes, that would fall within the rubric, but that's a necessary condition.
Let me ask you this. One of the cases cited in the briefs, older case, and I know now we've codified by statute what used to be case law development, but Mount v. Radford Trust involved an analogous issue where someone filed a derivative suit without making the demand or explaining why that would be futile. And the remedy in the last paragraph of the opinion that the court imposed was you have to dismiss this thing unless you can amend it and then explain why a demand would be futile or how you've made the demand. So that seems to suggest that we're going to hold the case. In other words, it's not a categorical dismissal. You can file, and then you can cure, and then either dismiss or go forward. Why wouldn't we not do that in this instance? What makes this different from that particular scenario?
Well, that reference presupposes that a futility requirement exists.
I understand, but my point doesn't go to that. It goes to your assertion that it just has to be dismissed out of hand, which seems inconsistent with a remedy of allowing someone to amend. Right? I mean, if you don't have jurisdiction, you can't allow someone to amend. You just have to dismiss it. Then they make the demand, then they come back, or they do whatever they have to do.
Well, Your Honor, there is an LLC Act, a command by the General Assembly, that states before you commence the action, you must make demand. And that is a standing requirement. The standing requirement...
Does the code say it's a standing requirement?
If you look at the title of the code, it says that it is a... It says it uses standing. And that is consistent with every...
The title's state... Okay. That's a bit tricky territory for us.
Sure, sure. It can be used as guidance. It's not dispositive, but it can be used as guidance.
But the title says standing, semicolon, condition precedent. Why is it natural to read standing to be A, which is you're someone who should be able to complain about this, which is what true standing is, and B is, and if you are someone who's got enough interest to complain about this, you got to cross some bridges to get there, and one of them is to send this demand, which, according to the title, appears to be in sequence B, condition precedent. So I think the title, if we look at it at all, hurts you.
I don't believe so, because I believe that, again, standing, the demand requirement goes to the ability of the member to actually possess the cause of action to begin with. And so therefore, and again, this would be the only court that I know of, the only court in the country that I'm aware of that would find that at a person's noncompliance with a demand requirement and derivative action is not a failure of the standing requirement and requires dismissal, to my knowledge. So
I understand the formalistic logic, but in terms of the purpose that, as your opposing counsel argued, the purpose that underlies this idea seems to be that before you purport to speak for the corporation and sue on its behalf, shouldn't the corporation have at least a crack at, you know, vindicating its own interests, and therefore the management of the corporation, the board, should have a chance to do that? So if that is the underlying purpose, then what's the point of just dismissing altogether? Why isn't that purpose satisfied by holding the case in abeyance and giving him that chance?
Because, you know, part of the purpose of it is to prevent a lawsuit in the first place. A lawsuit, once the commencement of a lawsuit, and I think sometimes we as attorneys forget this, but in the real world, there are real world consequences to being sued. Look at this, in this complaint in particular, our clients have been accused of all sorts of malfeasance. And that goes directly to not only their personal attack on their personal integrity, but also on the corporation and the reputation of the corporation. So one of the fundamental purposes of the 90-day requirement is to give the corporation, the LLC, the opportunity to resolve the issue without there being a lawsuit filed in a public forum. That is one of the fundamental requirements of that 90-day requirement, of that demand requirement. And I can't stress that enough, how in the world of corporate governance, it is so important that corporations not have to undergo and deal with litigation that could be dealt with internally.
Is this a piece of litigation that could have been dealt with internally?
There was no chance. This suit was filed in 2012.
So it was late, but I mean, if there had been a 90-day notice, is there some proffer that, yeah, if we'd have gotten the notice, there are things we would have thought about or could have considered?
Well, you know, the genie's out of the bottle, so I can't.
You can't even hypothesize one?
Well, yeah, I'm always hesitant to speculate, but it is in 2012, given the conditions, there. It's difficult for me to do that, but I could see reasonable business-minded people being able to sit down and work out a business solution. I think that's always the presumption.
But if those reasonable business-minded people still exist, why can't they do it today? Or why couldn't they have done it yesterday or last week or last month or last year?
Well, since that time, you know, there have been 13 lawsuits filed in this action. So I think at this point, I think we're out of the territory of reasonableness.
You had an answer to Justice Kelsey, if I'm correct, where you said this invoked subject matter jurisdiction. Have you abandoned that?
Oh, no, it does. This does implicate subject matter jurisdiction in our standing.
Right, well, I just wanted to make sure you were still there. Why doesn't this instead, at best, invoke active jurisdiction, the manner in which the court takes the case, as opposed to subject matter jurisdiction, which goes to the power of the court over the subject matter? Why is this, at best, active jurisdiction, perhaps with the standing argument as a complement to it?
Well, Your Honor, I'll have to go back to Professor Bryson's discussions in law school on active jurisdiction.
Well, the problem, it's hard to look at this as a subject matter jurisdiction case, because the circuit courts have subject matter jurisdiction over these disputes. How do they acquire the ability to use their power is active jurisdiction. And active jurisdiction cannot be, you would solve the problem that I think you walked into about subject matter jurisdiction, because the idea that you could raise this and void a trial court or an appellate court's ruling on the matter 25 years later is not a very attractive development.
I mean, it might be akin to a notice of appeal in this court where, you know, if nobody flagged it or whatever, this court still has the power to adjudicate the appeal, but if someone does object and then timely raises it, well, then the court can act on it and then, as in this instance, dismiss without prejudice. So I don't know if Chief Justice's suggestion is necessarily antithetical to what you want, but it's a perhaps a more appealing path forward.
Well, I think that subject matter jurisdiction, I think, is used broadly. I think what we're, if to be precise, standing goes to justiciability. So certainly under 17.1, the court, the circuit courts have the power to hear all claims, tort, whether brought under tort or contract. Obviously, they have that power. What we're talking about here is that we have a plaintiff that lacks the ability to bring that claim forward. So think of it like a turtle. The turtle has no shell. Then you file the demand requirement. Well, first of all, you have the interest, and then you have the then you file demand. You wait the 90 days. Then the turtle gets the shell, and then with the shell, it can walk across the line. Now, the court always has the power to hear the cause of action, so long as it is a proper plaintiff that possesses the cause of action. This plaintiff did not possess the cause of action. The corporation still owns the still has
still possesses the cause of action, because by the plain language of the LLC Act, this plaintiff failed to satisfy all of the prerequisites to obtain standing.
All right, thank you. Your time has expired. Rebuttal?
Thank you, and I know my time is brief, so I just have three quick points. It seems that my colleague has gotten himself tied up in formalistic knots on the standing issue. Because the standing issue goes to who has an interest in seeing this matter resolved. Dorothy owned 72% of this LLC, the LLC that's being gutted by her sons. She had a strong interest.
Right, but the difference is she's acting on behalf of the corporation as opposed to her own. I know it's formalistic, but I mean,
right.
So isn't there a difference there?
No, I mean, she is the proper party to bring the action before the court to have the matter adjudicated. She has exactly the right incentives. So she is a proper party before the court. And whether she satisfied the conditions precedent is a different question. And it's addressed in a different subsection of 1042. As for authority from other jurisdictions, I want to emphasize that Virginia's LLC statute is different from most jurisdictions.
Can I interrupt you for a second? Are there any cases that your opponent cites that directly addresses the failure to file a derivative pre-suit demand, the characterization of that failure as jurisdictional, and the dismissal without leave to cure?
Certainly not in Virginia, and I'm not aware of any cases, not none that they've cited.
So the cases I saw that said standing is jurisdictional are just the Lujan, you know, cases that all say that. If you don't have any justiciable interest, you can't go forward.
That's right. And I see my time has expired, so unless there are any further questions.
All right. Thank you very much. Call the next case.